All right, welcome to another episode of Peak Health Unlocked. I am one of your hosts, Mark Champagne, alongside
Dr. Rhett Langley
and Dr. Philip Gallegos.
We interview experts discussing the latest science, technology, and wellness practices to help unlock your peak health.
Make sure to stick around at the end of the episode where we have a deep dive and talk about the most interesting topics from the interview.
And this podcast would not be possible without the support of Thrive Performance and Regenerative Medicine, a team prepared to go all in with you to craft your personalized peak health plan. Visit the link in the show notes for a range of services.
Thanks for being here and have a thriving day.
Today we are speaking with Ryan Smith, who is the co-founder of True Diagnostic, the team behind the world's most advanced epigenetic test, TrueAge, testing up to 425 times more spots on the DNA than any other age predictor. All right, guys, I'm going to pause you because I can see we're going to jump in real fast here. So, but I definitely want to get your response, Ryan, to what longevity means to you first, and then we can just pick right back up and jump into this. It's going to be fun.
Yeah. Well, first and foremost, I love the fact that you all start the podcast with that question, just because, you know, for me, aging, you know, my background was in, you know, biochemistry as an undergrad, went to medical school, did all the actual schooling, got to the clinical stuff and just decided it wasn't for me. And so, you know, over these couple years since leaving medical school, what I really sort of developed as a philosophy is the thought process that aging is absolutely a disease, and one that can be modified and managed in a preventative way to really boost the overall health span and lifespan of everyone. And so longevity to me means, you know, both living a good lifespan, but also sort of treating aging itself as a disease and being proactive in that approach.
That is super interesting. I like that response. It provides some good flavor across all, because like I mentioned, everyone's answering the same question. So there's definitely themes that are running through, but that's a really cool perspective. I like that. Rhett, Philip, any thoughts?
Go ahead.
You guys still on this podcast?
We have so many thoughts. We don't know which thoughts we have. No, I was going to say is like, I'm excited for this talk. We can cut this out of the actual talk, but I'm excited for this one because the guy that runs the testing on aging definitely is going to have a different dynamic than some of the other people we've spoken to. And just to give you an idea, Ryan, I mean, we've talked to people all over the place. The first female that we interviewed was based on movement and how that interacts with, you know, the brain and aging. So we've just been all across the board. So we're excited.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that it's interesting to hear all those different points because I think everyone approaches aging a little bit different. You know, it's sort of a bit of experience. I think that, you know, prior to some of all the work that I've done in this industry, I would have said, you know, aging is inevitable and that it's just a part of life and that longevity is useless without quality of life. And so not really a goal. And I think that that's definitely changed and would love to add some context into why I believe that's the case for me.
Yeah, go for it.
Yeah, definitely touch on that.
Yeah. Well, I think that, you know, I started, a lot of what we focused on are really interesting and novel peptide products, which can affect quality of life and really address certain types of diseases or deficiencies. And we actually hit a really keen market. We sort of started to fill a need for a lot of these integrative physicians because we were addressing things that their patients wanted in more advanced ways that sort of gave them a lot more ability to treat patients the way they wanted to. And a lot of these things are, you know, the patients in these fields are patients who are super involved in their own health and extremely bought in. They're paying, you know, cash for a lot of these services and really are trying to address their life quality and less so thinking about health span. But the one thing that sort of kept coming up is how do we know what all of these interventions are doing in the long term? You know, are they reducing risk of these diseases? You know, by their effect on biomarkers in the short term, you could see that they're having really good effects. And from quality of life and anecdotal reports, you can see that they're really making a difference. But what is the effect on the long term? And that was always sort of a question. But without, you know, 40-year follow-up studies where we have a placebo-controlled group who didn't take the intervention, it's, you know, extremely hard to vet. And, you know, I give a lot of credit to Dr. Sinclair, David Sinclair from Harvard, and his book Lifespan, which really got people thinking a little bit differently and thinking that aging can actually be prevented and changed, and that can affect lifespan as well as health span. And that sort of coincided as well with a lot of developments in the first, the creation of a really objective and well-validated biomarker for age. And having that objective biomarker immediately changed my philosophy on everything we were doing in this space, because no longer did we have to wait 40 years to find out if a product was, you know, helping someone live longer or helping someone live healthier. We could really now evaluate it sort of immediately based on these correlation algorithms. And so that really started to change things, because in these large scale statistic populations, you can see that reducing this epigenetic aging rate, as they say, reduces mortality. If you reduce it by 7 years, you can reduce mortality by 50%. So 50% of people are younger sick. And that's huge. And not to mention the lifespan correlations as well. And so the development of that technology, the idea that you could now look in real time at how interventions are affecting people. And then the secondary thing about that is that you can look in real time at how interventions are affecting you as an individual. People always talk about personalized medicine. And generally that means that, you know, you try and treat someone based on, you know, their symptoms or their genetics. But this is really personalized medicine, where you can look at how particular interventions in short periods of time affect one person versus how they affect another. And that can really help sort of change your treatment to correlate to those longer lifespans and better health spans.
Yeah, I was going to, just to touch on the importance of this, I'll take a step back and kind of talk about how it's very relevant in today's age. You know, you think of the human and instant gratification, and you touch on peptides, and it's funny, and peptides are a large part of our practice. And for the listeners out there, I would push you to learn about more about peptides, because they're really cool. They have a lot of really helpful effects that can take place. And there are some peptides that are strictly used for what you would say an anti-aging effect. But it's hard to tell some patients about that, because that there's no instant gratification in that. But I can tell you that the things are changing. I have a patient that's 22 years old, and this guy is nailing me left and right with research and peptides and rapamycin and all sorts of things. And so there is a growing body of people out there that are interested in this and understand the importance. And I'm just going to follow up with one other question. And I'll start it off with a basic question, but we can maybe a basic explanation of what true age is. And because I could tell you right now, it's going to be a large part of our practice and a large part of the management of our patients, because it is so important.
Absolutely. And I'd love to give, the introduction, I think, is that it is a DNA-based test, which looks at epigenetics. And epigenetics are the changes which happen above your genome. I always sort of explain these by saying, the DNA in your fingernails has the exact same DNA as your heart tissue. And what makes those so different? What those cell types so different? And the idea is that some genes are being expressed in your nail tissue that are not expressed in your heart, and vice versa. And all of these epigenetic programming changes are controlled by your body. And so that is sort of how epigenetics can have a difference in how your body operates. But there are a lot of epigenetic changes which can actually happen. One of the biggest changes is called methylation. This is where you put sort of a small tag on different locations in your genes in order to inactivate the transcription. So in order for genes to really have an effect, they need to be transcribed and turned into messenger RNA, which then goes to peptides and proteins. And that really builds the infrastructure. That's the central dogma of DNA. The methylation on these DNA points can actually turn off certain genes. But through the years, particularly starting in 2008, so this is still very, very new and recent, they noticed that these methylation changes change predictably with age. And so in 2013, there were two algorithms created by Dr. Steve Horvath and Dr. Greg Hannum, which really created these predictive clocks where they could look at the methylation in your DNA and tell you exactly how old you are. And that was pretty cool. You know, there are a lot of applications of this. Some of the first applications were use in dating refugees to see if they were minors or not. And if they were minors, obviously they had asylum in the country that they were sort of traveling to. And if they weren't, then they wouldn't. And so that was a big implication. You know, people are also using this on sort of crime scene investigations to date how old a person is. And so those are some pretty big developments. But as I mentioned, the thing that really became exciting to me is whenever this was able to start being a sort of a tool to measure how different interventions are working in a person's life, to not just show their age, but also to predict outcomes. One of the things that, you know, it is inevitable to talk about when we talk about aging is the fact that aging is the number one biggest biomarker or the number one biggest risk factor for all chronic disease. And so that includes Alzheimer's, cancer, cardiovascular disease, diabetes. Your risk significantly increases the older you get. And unfortunately, though, it's not perfect. You know, most of us can probably think of someone who's 70 years of age who needs a lot of assistance and help in living day-to-day life. And then some of us can probably think of a couple 90-year-olds who look fantastic and are still operating perfectly. And so while age is a really good risk factor, there's still a lot of heterogeneity and a lot of difference in how people age. And so this biomarker, this aging biomarker that looks at your DNA, was really the first time you could objectively say, hey, your body looks this old. And it's really just a good snapshot of your health and how you are aging. And its implications are wide and varied, but it really provides a real-time personalized medicine tool to evaluate the things that you're doing and really perfecting how you're handling your body for the aging process.
So as Rhett was alluding to, our clients and your clients as well are coming in much, much more educated these days. So Start with two questions, one more basic. So people are going to ask, well, what's the difference between the measuring biological age with methylation versus telomeres? Because the most common people, way of measuring people here is about telomere length and it's shortening throughout time. And then second question would be, you also see other measures of measuring age. So you can go online and you can calculate your biological age, or you can even, I've seen these microbiome companies such as Viome or Longevity jumping in the game as well and doing a measure of biological age. So if you can speak on those two things, from the basic to how the true age compares to those different products.
Yeah, definitely. I think that, there are a lot of different ways to calculate biological age, and there have been for a long time, for what it's worth. You know, I always talk about there in the 50s, there were biological age metrics which just said, hey, what's your chronological age minus the number of packs a day you smoke? And so there have always been sort of crude metrics, but what we're starting to get into now is really, really specific metrics. And there are a lot of different ones of these. Obviously, telomere length is the most popular. After it won, sort of the telomere science won the Nobel Prize, this was really, everyone thought, a great marker of aging. And just to recap on some of that telomere biology for any listeners who don't know, the telomeres are sort of the caps at the end of our DNA. And every time we replicate our DNA, those get a little bit shorter. Over time, they slowly start to disappear. And when they do disappear, the cell goes under what they call replicative senescence. And that's when it sort of just pauses and stop replicating. It stays metabolically active and sort of is considered a senescent cell, which is secreting sort of all this pro-inflammatory cytokines, which are often deemed part of the inflammaging process. But this is, everyone thought that this was a great marker because it was correlated to how old a cell is. And that is true. And it has a lot of really good clinical applications, but its correlation to age-related outcomes traditionally tends to be a lot less than things like epigenetic aging. The typical correlation values for telomere length are around 0.5, whereas, if you look at epigenetic biological aging, they're around double that at 0.95. And so the epigenetic age is highly, highly correlated to age, whereas telomere length less so. But there are a lot of other ones, as you mentioned too, you know, and they're proteomics based clocks to determine age. There are transcriptomic clocks, metabolomic clocks. There are a lot of these different things, but far and away, it seems like epigenetic age is by far the most precise. And there are a couple reasons in thinking behind that. But the one that's most exciting is it looks like the reason that the epigenetic age is so great at predicting this biological age or the age of your body is because some of the things, the genes that are being methylated might actually contribute to the aging process rather than just being a reflection of how you're aging.
I find this stuff so fascinating. I mean, and it seems like it's advancing at like Mach speed. I'm curious, Ryan, just, you know, if you think back when you first got involved in all of this, like what surprised you most that you didn't expect getting into this whole field?
Yeah, well, to be honest, I didn't expect an aging biomarker period, I think. So I was so excited whenever some of these, you know, the applications to these were seemed like cool tricks to me. But really, whenever the application started to look at how do we reverse this process? That's when my eyes started to open, because there was a study published last September, and this is actually the moment I decided, hey, I have to get involved with this. And it was, they published a study that's often nicknamed the TRIM trial out of UCLA. And what it looked at is metformin, growth hormone, and DHEA, and how that was able to affect the epigenetic age of a patient. They sort of hypothesized that using the growth hormone would be able to regenerate the thymus, and that as a result, the immune system would improve, and as a result, you would sort of have a reduced epigenetic age. And they only did this in 9 patients, but the thought process definitely seemed to play out, and they were able to reduce the age of a patient by around 2.5 years in 1.5 years of time. And that, to me, was where I started to say, hey, I absolutely want to get involved and vet this technology against a lot of different therapies. Because, you know, as far as growth hormone, metformin, and DHEA go, it's actually pretty common. You know, they're pretty widely available, and I imagine that there's probably so many other medications out there, or lifestyle interventions, or supplementation, which can also have an effect. And with this objective biomarker, it finally became something that the science could be applied to, rather than just anecdotal. Hey, I feel better on this, and hey, this person lived to their 90s and drank, you know, 5 cups of coffee every day. I should drink 5 cups of coffee, right? It turned it more of a these anecdotal experiences to an actual science, which could be compared and contrasted versus other interventions. And that is, it was super exciting to me. And that was really, I think, the point I thought, this is too exciting not to be sort of involved with, and I have to try.
Yeah, one of the things I can definitely add to that, Ryan, is for us, especially in the clinical world, you really want to focus on results. And I think patients really appreciate that, you know, when you can, because you can tell, you can teach the patient a lot of information, and you can teach yourself a lot of information, you can have a really good relationship. But at the end of the day, you want to be able to measure, first off, you want to have a method to make sure the patient's following the instructions, but also measure results so that we can see like, hey, it's working. So for us, this is an amazing test. And I know that with the data, the metadata, and all the outside stuff to include with your biomarker, and maybe you can talk about that a little bit, but then you can actually see when you retest, and I know you guys are doing some follow-up studies and sending patients additional information every couple of weeks, you can see benefit from that.
Definitely. Yeah. And I think that you're bringing up exactly one of the biggest problems, or I should say one of the biggest frustrations. Again, I don't want to knock telomere testing, because it's absolutely, you know, a useful metric. But a lot of times telomere testing is difficult to change with intervention. And a lot of times it's not linked to predictive outcomes. And I think that oftentimes that makes patients think, what's the point of measuring it if I can't change it? And if it's not telling me what my risk factors are, how do I know how to use it? And although they're now the science has definitely improved, and that was some of the initial frustration, I think, with telomere testing that doesn't exist here. It really makes, as you mentioned, it useful for patients where they're able to say, hey, I'm getting good feedback, you know, just like they would from a financial advisor on the state of their health. They're getting an overall snapshot, on the finances, you're getting an overall snapshot on the state of their health. And I think that that's super valuable in making a hard concept in this sort of idea of medicine, which has been generally inaccessible for a lot of people for a long time, a lot more sort of accessible to every patient.
So in regards to the differences in the tests, so let's say, so my chronological age is 46. Let's say I do both tests. My methylation test comes back and I'm 46 or 45. And then my telomere test comes back and I'm 48. Is there any way to resolve those tests? Is there any correlations between those tests? How would you explain to a client when they have differences in those types of testing?
Well, it's hard to compare the two. And the reason being is that each of those have been sort of validated on different data sets. And so until you have, I should say, the same patients who are getting both telomere testing and epigenetic testing, it can be a little bit tough to make a head-to-head comparison. There generally, I would say you could weight those two a little bit by saying that, you know, that the biological epigenetic age is a little bit more highly correlated and therefore probably should be trusted a little bit more. But the other interesting thing about it is that investigation by looking at telomere length and epigenetic methylation has sort of already happened. Dr. Horvath, as I mentioned, who sort of, I think he's going to win the Nobel Prize one day for this sort of creation of these algorithms. But he actually has some telomere studies published where he's able to look at the epigenetics of an individual and predict their telomere length. And that those predictions on telomere length can actually be predictive for things like cardiovascular disease or risk of death. And so I would generally say that it's hard to compare head to head, but what you really want to look at is the correlations to outcomes, because that's really how the rubber meets the road and physicians and patients are able to synthesize that testing information into ways you can affect your health.
Yeah, you're actually reading my mind. I want to, and forgive me if I remember this incorrectly, but, you know, clinical endpoint in the medical world is what we always say. And for the patient, that just means, what does this mean to me? Like you said, well, clinical outcome. And I think I saw something on the webinar that showed that with this data that you guys are incorporating, all this data that increases the power of the study, you're actually able to look at different factors. One of them was even the change in cancer risk, mm-hmm. Based on differences in biological age. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. You definitely remembering that correctly. You know, the with the Horvath clock in particular, they've been able to compare this data to what happens to these patients, right? So they track these patients longitudinally over time, or in the case of a lot of these studies, they look back at, they have these blood samples from patients who have already had some type of health outcome from, 30 to 40 years ago, and they're able to test that and then correlate it to outcomes. And they've done that with cancer. And so, for instance, for every year that you're older, 1 year older biologically than you are chronologically, you have a 6% risk of developing cancer within the next 5 years, and you have a 14% increased risk of dying of cancer in the next 3 years. And so that's a pretty, a stark jump in some of those things. I often like to also point to a metabolic marker, which is very, very predictive. It's called ABCG1. And whenever that is methylated, you actually have a much higher risk for developing diabetes within 7 years. And traditionally, most clinicians will assess diabetes risk using fasting insulin or HbA1c levels, which give a good idea of sort of how well you're using insulin to get the sugar out of your system. And compared head to head, this biomarker, this methylation biomarker, is actually better than fasting insulin and HbA1c, which means that, it really helps clinicians detect diabetes risk earlier and then know when to implement interventions like lifestyle change or diet interventions. And so, we've talked about a lot of the implications, but the other implication is that you can tell sort of a trajectory a lot quicker and then make steps to intervene immediately rather than when they're halfway to the disease.
Yeah, we're really excited about that biomarker and seeing the data on that when it starts coming out and seeing what results our clients have, because we're also instituting continuous glucose monitors as well. Absolutely. So we're trying to really hone in on being metabolically healthy. So we talked a lot about the test itself, but I know the listeners are going to really want to know, now I have this result or have this test, but what is it that I can do to either slow down my aging, reverse my aging? And there's many things. Like, we started off the talk and we talked about peptides, and I really do want to do a deep dive into peptides, but there's also some things that are, there's the free things that you can do, and then there's the things that cost money, the interventions that you have to purchase some type of medication or peptide. So let's, if we can first start with the things that clients can do that are like sleep, fasting, if you can touch on those types of topics first.
Yeah, absolutely. And I should preface these topics by saying that, you know, we're still very, very new into a lot of this research. As I mentioned, you know, September of last year, so a year ago, was when they published the first interventional trial. And that only had 9 patients, so it wasn't a huge trial. And actually, there's about to be the second intervention trial that's coming out here pretty soon, which looks at just diet intervention. And so to date, we don't have a lot of published interventional trial, but we do have, I would say, a lot of information on what helps people live longer and healthier. And we can sort of speculate on things that might move the needle and have some good anecdotal feedback already through our testing. You know, I think that one of the first things, as you mentioned, is just general lifestyle. And for here, it really, I would say, coincides with exactly with what you would expect. you know, these are the easy things, right? So making sure that you exercise frequently, making, you know, that type of exercise, you know, decreases your metabolic risk. It helps with your mitochondrial biogenesis. It helps with reducing inflammation in your body, which leads to that inflammaging process. Just exercising regularly, both strength and sort of that cardiovascular training are both helpful. Making sure you get regular and consistent sleep, making sure that you're not, you know, your circadian rhythms aren't changing from day to day, and that you don't have to always get a lot, but you, as long as you're sort of consistent in the time and approach, we also have seen that move the needle. And then even some other things, diet, we can go into a lot, some things like, drinking at least one glass of red wine once a month tends to have positive effects and correlations with better epigenetic aging.
Only one a month?
Yeah, I was going to say, I was hoping for one a day here.
work with us, Ryan. Come on.
Absolutely. No, and for what it's worth, the trend actually continued to once a week, but wasn't studied at more frequent intervals. But I think there's a lot of other data to suggest that it might have some extension benefits. But from an epigenetic standpoint, you know, where the jury's still out, but things like diet, you know, eating more fish and more chicken is traditionally associated with better epigenetic aging, as well as sort of the Mediterranean diet or the fasting mimicking diets, or things where you're just fasting in general. All of those seem to have a positive effect and are relatively easy to implement free of charge. In fact, some of the fasting probably saves you money.
Ryan, are you seeing anything in terms of effects with mental fitness, like, you know, breath work, meditation, journaling, like any of these kind of practices?
Absolutely. It's hard for us because a lot of those practices can vary from individual to individual, just like nutrition. Sure. Just like nutrition, it's a little bit hard to control the how effective the behavior is. But what we do see is that stress absolutely makes a difference. And that generally the people who have some of those activities, those mental activities, traditionally have a lot less stress. And so so they're absolutely correlated.
Love it. Guys, anything on your side?
Yeah, so we've talked about the free stuff. Let's talk about the things that people would have to have some type of monetary investment. And so some of the peptides. Yeah.
Peptides.
Yeah, and this is, you know, this is a very, very broad and complex topic. You know, the way that I traditionally always like to think about it is by viewing it within the 9 hallmarks of aging. And those encompass things like, you know, nutrient sensing, telomere attrition, as we already talked about, things like mitochondrial dysfunction, you know, sort of all of these different things. And so really starting with it, I think that probably the one most popular, the most talked about interventions, one you all have already mentioned, which is senolytic medications like rapamycin. And so, rapamycin isn't necessarily a senolytic, but it's also viewed as sort of reducing the secretory associated phenotype. And you've heard me mention inflammaging a couple times now. This inflammaging process is basically a chronic, low grade, sterile inflammation that results from a lot of your cells being in this sort of what they call the zombie state, or this senescent state, where they're sort of metabolically paused or metabolically active, but not sort of regenerating or proliferating. And what happens is that those cells can secrete a lot of inflammation, and this inflammation has a lot of effects over time. And particularly, you know, whenever you were to use rapamycin on animals, it can increase lifespan significantly. There was a study on dogs that says it increased lifespan by 30%. And really, we don't have a lot of that data as it relates to humans yet, but there's a lot of hope for that molecule and other types of senolytic molecules for things like osteoarthritis or kidney disease or a lot of other different things. And so I would be remiss if I didn't talk about rapamycin, or alternatively, sort of the other senolytic, which is pretty popular, dasatinib and quercetin. That combination has also been thoroughly studied.
So I know there's a lot of concern about rapamycin, you know, the toxicities of rapamycin. If you can touch on how rapamycin is used differently in an anti-aging or longevity strategy than it would be clinically.
Definitely. And so rapamycin is often used, sort of that whole pathway is almost an immune suppressant, and for things like transplant surgeries or other things like that. But the way that it's used in this anti-aging space is to really decrease that phenotype of inflammation. And so traditionally it's done once weekly at low doses. Generally, most people in humans will do it around 4 to 6 milligrams. But that's a pretty arbitrary dose. It's sort of gained a lot of popularity, but not a lot of scientific backing behind it. It generally was popularized by a couple different physicians, Dr. Alan Green and Dr. Mikhail Blagoskloney. And generally, it seems that people are having good results in there that don't have the same side effects as the more consistent dosing at higher doses. Just really once weekly has had effect in animals to significantly increase their lifespan.
Ryan, can you touch on also metformin? I get a lot of questions about metformin, especially from some of my younger patients, and I try to steer some of them away. So maybe just touch on that a bit if you don't mind.
Yeah, you know, metformin is complicated, and there are a lot of advocates on both sides who feel very, very strongly about its use. You know, I think that the idea is that it's inhibiting complex 1 of the mitochondria, and that has some longevity benefits associated with it. It's even being investigated as sort of as a drug for anti-aging with, you know, sort of having the diagnosis of aging as a disease, which is exciting. But it also has a lot of side effects. It has some GI side effects, which are not pleasant. And so there are a lot of people who look at rapamycin as a way to sort of extend life, but it's not the cleanest type of molecule. I think what we traditionally see a lot of people in this space moving to things like berberine or some other things. Is that typically your experience as well?
Yeah. Big concern a lot from a lot of our clients are younger clients that are athletic, and there's a decrease in athletic performance that's associated with metformin. So we've kind of steered away from it, putting it on our younger clients, but a lot of our older clients, 70 years old or so, we're more inclined to entertain that with them.
Definitely. And for what it's worth, you know, like I mentioned in the TRIM trial, they were using metformin, growth hormone, and DHEA. And so metformin was part of that drug cocktail and might, in fact, be responsible for some of the anti-aging effects that we see. And without having a trial that looks at growth hormone and DHEA sort of independently, we won't know. But I think there is a lot of evidence to suggest that metformin is an anti-aging product. But as you mentioned, comes with some side effects. And sort of transitioning over to just another product that, you know, is widely controversial, but often used. I think growth hormone is that molecule. You know, even since 1996, it was sort of popularized as this great anti-aging molecule, but has received a lot of pushback from even the FDA with being one of the only drugs you can't prescribe off-label. And so it has a lot of, I should say, controversy around it. But as I mentioned before, we do know that it is effective at helping restore the thymus. We do know that for effect fact in some of these trials. And it also helps with sort of quality of life. You know, a lot of people like it because they're traditionally can be, you know, healthier and feel better from everything from, you know, some blood work and other biomarkers to, you know, athletic performance and their skin appearance. And so that's another one that I would say is on the list. And obviously accompanying it are a lot of the growth hormone secretagogues, which are peptide based and have gained a lot of popularity over the last couple of years.
Yeah, you like Rhett said, you read my mind on that one. I was getting ready to ask you about the secretagogues. You know, what's the difference between somebody taking just straight growth hormone, like somorolin, or taking a secretagogue and different mechanisms of action? Is there a different safety profile? Are we preventing the disruption of our natural HPA access?
Yeah. That definitely. And so this is actually how I would say TaylorMade got relatively, you know, popular in the market by offering some alternatives to growth hormone, because as effective as growth hormone is at changing quality of life, it also has some significant negative effects. You know, one is insulin sensitivity issues. You know, that's one of the reasons that metformin was actually included in this TRIM trial, because they wanted to mitigate the effects that it has metabolically on insulin sensitivity. It can actually make your body sort of less sensitive to insulin and then sort of develop a diabetic phenotype. And so that's obviously not great. You know, beyond that, it's also very, very expensive. It's one of the most expensive medications that you can get. And beyond that, you know, a lot of people think that just like you know, if you were to take testosterone for men, you know, a lot of times they shut down their endogenous production, which is why, you know, their testicles oftentimes shrink or something like that. And the question is, does that happen with exogenous growth hormone as well? And the idea is that, yeah, you know, there's some evidence to suggest that it does. And so these growth hormone secretagogues, instead of just acting like growth hormone, what they do is they encourage your pituitary to release its own natural growth hormone. So they mimic these sort of hormones which are formed in your hypothalamus that then go to the pituitary to stimulate release. And by doing this, you can essentially have the higher levels of growth hormone in the blood, higher IGF-1 levels, which are the downstream molecule for growth hormone, and then have a lot of the clinical benefits. You know, one of the most famous growth hormone secretagogues is a molecule called tesamorelin, which is FDA approved for AIDS lipodystrophy. And what they saw there is the average increase in IGF-1 is around 181 points. And so we know that's a very, very effective growth hormone secretagogue. And you also get reduced carotid intima media thickness, which is generally associated with cardiovascular disease and stroke. You get reduced visceral adipose tissue, which also has a lot of negative cardiovascular and metabolic side effects. And so that's a very, very popular one that just sort of doesn't have the same insulin type effects issues and doesn't have a lot of the downsides while still maintaining all the effects of growth hormone.
Ryan, I've got a bit of a pivot question for you. I'm just curious because I know that you guys have recently launched the form or your forms.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just curious what you guys are seeing. Like what are some of the common questions and chats that are coming up from people in your ecosystem that we could jam on?
Well, yeah, that love that question. I you know, the form is very, very new for us. And so, you know, we're still, I would say, trying to cultivate a lot of those conversations. But
sure.
Actually two big groups that I would say that are already pretty involved. One group revolves around, I should say, this idea of plasma exchange or young plasma. This is a really interesting topic. You know, a couple of years back, they actually did some studies in rats where they sort of connected an old rat to a young rat and then exchanged their blood. And what they saw is that the older rat regenerated and became younger and healthier, whereas the younger rat actually seemed to be a little bit poisoned by the older rat's blood and actually aged more rapidly, which brought up a lot of different questions. But you know, that's it's even been popularized in shows like Silicon Valley, where they have their, you know, the blood boys who they receive transfusions from. But it seems like it has held out that there are certain things in younger blood or the lack of certain things in older blood, which might have some anti-aging effects. And so this is a really big area that people are really curious about, especially because even most recently, there's a study out of India that was published showing that these young plasma transfers could actually reduce epigenetic aging of animals as well. And so, you know, we're actually doing a trial on that and have a lot of people interested. That's one of the biggest topics on the forum.
Yeah, no, it's very interesting, especially since plasma is at the forefront of the news right now with it being used to treat COVID. So it's it's a very interesting product.
Yeah, definitely. It also makes studies and investigations like this a little bit more difficult because obviously convalescent plasma is a important treatment for COVID and makes it a little bit harder for us to do some of this anti-aging analysis. But we can definitely see its importance.
Yeah, what I was going to say is I love the idea of the forum because especially in 2020, you need to analyze all different types of evidence, the scientific evidence, the data, the anecdotal, a place where people can talk about this stuff. I know you guys are also kind of in the forefront of some other studies with peptides. You did talk about the plasma, some other things going on that you listed that people could get involved with.
Yeah. Yeah, we've got a ton of interventional trials. We've got around 14 different IRBs where we're looking at how interventions can change. And we're starting with really small groups because what we're hoping to find is sort of hopefully an arrow that points us in the right direction to do larger scale analysis. And we've already got some amazing things that we've sort of stumbled upon. Things like there's a small community as well that likes an anti-aging product called GDF11. And this is it's a product that it has been shown to trigger sort of a calorie restriction like phenotype. It helps just, I think, overall in mouse studies sort of help regenerate mice to be younger. And we've seen some crazy results with people who are taking GDF11 on their epigenetic age, so much so that it's prompting a little bit more of investigation of, hey, why would we get such a wide variance with these people? And all of that has come from individual anecdotal trials, which are helping point us in the right direction for more thorough future analysis.
Yeah, I think that it's always under anecdotal evidence is always underrepresented. So kudos to you guys. But as we are starting to wrap up here, I wanted to ask a very interesting question for our listeners. I know that they're thinking about this, but I know you guys are a huge data center. You're collecting a lot of data, metadata. You ask a bunch of interesting questions on the surveys in addition to the biomarker tests. Can you think of a large ticket item that you can throw out to the listeners that you found maybe that you're like, wow, this just really trashes your biological age. This was something you really need to work on if you really want to take care of yourself. Maybe a couple of larger topics.
Ooh, that's difficult. I wish, I think that maybe in about 8 weeks, if you ask me, I'll have a definitive answer. I think that right now we might still be a little bit early. One of the things that we thought would have a huge impact was actually smoking. It looks like that might not be the case as much as we thought it was. I mean, we have actually some of our biggest deltas in a positive direction. Some people up to 15 years younger who still smoke, you know, 6 or 7 cigarettes a day. And so, not everything is as intuitive as we think it is, which makes that a little bit hard to say until we tease out sort of a lot of the different lifestyles. One of the things that I can say definitively makes a difference is pollution exposure. We've seen it epidemiologically, and we've seen it as well in anecdotal trials where certain locations have high levels of pollution can have a really negative effect.
Kind of along those lines, Ryan, I mean, I think it's a good lead into our final series question, which is, you know, what are you doing to achieve your peak health?
Yeah, a lot, I guess, is the answer.
What are your non-negotiables, I guess, at this point?
Yeah, so an interesting thing for me is that I'm actually around a little under a year older biologically than I am chronologically, which is not something that you want to see, especially for someone who does this type of testing on a basis, right? For me, the number one thing I think that I'm committed to is consistent exercise and clean eating. And I know that that's something that no one wants to hear. No one wants to say, hey, let's do those basics. They really want, a medication which can make a difference. And believe me, I've also experimented with quite a bit of different really novel medications on a personal level and have had some phenomenal results. I'm still a big believer in supplementation of key DNA regulation enzymes. So things like NAD therapy or the NAD precursor precursors like nicotinamide mononucleotide or nicotinamide riboside. I believe those are great and useful molecules. I also like things like SAMe or acetylmethionine, things that can help essentially regulate the DNA methylation process. And so I like those things because they're very, very low risk and they really just help support the natural functioning of your body, and then just trying to make everything else as healthy as possible. You know, I think all of those are interesting. And then I do believe in a rapamycin and a weekly dose as well.
I mean, I love that you started with some of these basics. I mean, Rhett, Philip, you can validate this as well. I feel like this whole series, I mean, we've obviously had very wide ranging conversations, and they're chock full of really great practices and tests and procedures and all of that. But at the end of the day, it seems to always come back to a lot of, you know, eat clean, move the body, play, you know, keep your mind stress-free as much as possible. So it's, I mean, I think it's a great message to put out there.
And even in our clinic, if the way we describe it is that we're one part ancestral living. So one part is the basics, eat clean, move, all these things that we've all discussed. And then the other part is doing the science and technology that we have to increase or boost performance. But it all starts off at the basics. So having interpersonal connections, love, happiness, going outside, getting some sun, all these things are the basis and are important.
Red wine.
more than one time a month.
Yeah, preferably. We're going to look for a different study.
For what it's worth, I love that you all call it ancestral living too, because I think that sort of talks and references the underlying biology that we evolved to have and why those things are so important.
We also like it because it disarms everything else. People can get behind it. You're like, you know, obviously thousands of years ago, people survived doing the right thing. So there has to be some sort of logic to it.
Yeah, absolutely. I love that term, and we'll actually probably use it myself a little bit in the future. So I'll give props to you. One of the other things, just as we're talking about epigenetic, and I know we're trying to wrap up, but you know, one of the things we're seeing from an epigenetic perspective is that things your great-great parents, great grandparents experience definitely affect you genetically. And so, you know, one thing that we're seeing influence people's sort of adherence to these regimens is that they're not only affecting their own life, but they're affecting the lives of their great grandchildren.
Absolutely.
Well, this was super fun. I mean, I feel like we could talk about this all day, but we want to respect your time, Ryan. So for me and both Rhett and Philip, a huge thanks for making some time.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me on, and hopefully I'd love to come back on whenever we have some of these other studies published to talk about the changing science as it continues to evolve.
Yeah, absolutely. We didn't even touch on some things that I wanted to touch more on, like epitalin, MOSC, some cool stuff like that.
Yeah, what I was going to say, Ryan, also to decrease everyone's stress level, especially for someone who has a ton of information, that we're going to have plenty of podcasts, and we definitely love to have you on in the future to go a little bit deeper on some of these topics for our listeners.
Yeah, I would love to. I have a ton of things I can say about epitalin, of MOD-SC, the SS31, a lot of those mitochondrial peptides, longevity peptides, and even one of my favorites, the 5-amino-1-MQ. And so if we ever want to talk mitochondria and performance and function, I'd love to hop back on.
Absolutely. Hey, when are you going to get the 5-amino-1-MQ again? We did it for a while. We had a batch right before you
we love it.
You stopped making it.
Oh, I love it as well. I was Dr. Wadowicz, who is one of the creators of this medication. They're actually doing some really interesting trials as it relates to epigenetics and 5-amino-1-MQ in muscle. And so they're actually doing some investigations even right down the road from us at the University of Kentucky. And so I doubt that we'll be able to get that back anytime soon, but are actually seeing what we can do to provide it in other formats, working with their group, Ridgeline Therapeutics. And for those of you, it's a very, very early pharmaceutical company, but with that molecule, I'm extremely excited about them.
Yeah, there's a ton of stuff. We have some epitalin that we're going to probably employ after we get our test results back, and then kind of loop back around, do some interventions, see what we can do, and then retest. So as far as that goes, how often do you recommend, let's say a client comes in, they get tested, we do some scheduled interventions, how often should we retest and expect changes with the interventions?
That's a great question, and one that is sort of becoming a moving target. Previously, you know, actually previously of just a couple of weeks ago, I would have said no more than 6 months in order to be statistically significant. However, with that being said, this trial that's about to be released showed a good statistical significance in just 8 weeks of interventions. And so I would say in order to be safe, I would recommend it at least 3 months. But you could, I would say that 3 months is the minimum, but I would say most of our practices are generally doing it once or twice a year.
Awesome. Awesome. Do you have just a fun question here? Is there a going winner on someone that's well below their biological age? What's the gap?
So right now it's 15 years and
wow.
Yeah, it's crazy. And actually this person is a very well-known person too. And so it's a fantastic, delta, one that we're, very, very surprised about. So much so actually, anytime we get a delta like that, we always retest, to make sure that we're not making any mistakes on the procedure. So 15 years is now the record, but unfortunately, we have some that are past 15 years on the negative side of things. And so yeah, hopefully no more records are set in that direction.
No kidding. Hopefully it's not a test that you received a couple weeks ago.
Yeah. And I should mention, you know, one thing just to hopefully get everyone who's listening to this excited as well is if we mentioned other tests which are coming out. One of those tests is actually a death prediction test, which, you know, has a lot of sort of ethical implications, but also might be a good way for people to sort of orient how they approach their health in a major way. And so look for that to be a little bit more popular as well. And for those of you who aren't afraid of that information, it will become available pretty soon.
Nothing gets results like telling you when you're going to die.
Yeah, good kidding, but
yeah, no kidding.
The thing that would scare me though is the use of insurance companies using that against you if they have that information. That's a whole other topic, but that would be...
Exactly. And that's, you know, one of the things that I shied away from in my initial, you know, there are actually insurance companies out there already who are offering you essentially to be a premium based on your epigenetic age values. And so they're already out there and already using it. But one thing I should mention is that is not at all our what we want this testing to be used for. We want it to be used to help improve people's lives. And all of our data is extremely secure and siloed.
Yeah, well, based on this talk, Ryan, it seems like we need you back weekly.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I'm sure we wouldn't run out of anything to talk about for a couple of years. But I do look forward to coming back and hopefully talking about some of those other things like Epitalon and some of the other really innovative molecules which might make a difference. And we could talk about performance as well. That's another area that's always fun to talk about. And so thank you all again for the time, but look forward to coming back.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Ryan.
We really appreciate you. Keep up the good work.
All right. Ryan Smith. That was interesting. Tons of information there. I love how how he described longevity, right? Just that aging is a disease in itself. That was a super interesting perspective.
Yeah, and also I think, you know, we have to look at the power of data. Really interesting how he was talking about smoking. We all know smoking kills. That's not what we're saying here, but I cannot wait till he comes back on and teaches us about what he learned, because I know the clients, the listeners out there are going to want to know what are the top three or four things I can do to really slow down aging besides Botox.
Yeah. But here's the thing with that. Like, I think what I'm getting from this whole series is that, you know, it's probably going to be challenging to come with that like hit list other than, okay, you know, what's really clear is the basics, right? Eating clean, moving, play, like relationships. And then, you know, when it goes past that, that's where having access to all this data, like you're saying, and testing and whatnot will be super beneficial to layer on top of the fundamentals, right? And personalize.
Well, that's what I love about this series, though, that it is teased out amongst people from different specialties and expertise levels and the top people in their fields, is that it comes down to basics. And that's what we want everybody to know that's out there listening. It is the easiest but most difficult thing to do.
Yeah.
And this start with the basics, and then from there you can get fancy. And that's where we hope to guide people and really look at the information, look at the data, and say, look, this is probably something that's high level data that you could use to apply in your life to increase performance in whatever facet of your life that you're trying to improve. But the beauty of it is all the other stuff is free. You just got to put in the effort.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Make no mistake though. If you look at what he was saying, let's just touch on that for a second, where the clinical endpoint, one of the things he said was a 1 year change or one to 2 year change in your biological age can put you at increased risk of cancer within 5 years of 6%. So if you're within, let's say 4 or 6 years, you're talking about a 20% increase in cancer. And so the clinical endpoint of telling someone, hey, you can decrease your risk of cancer by 20%, is pretty huge, you know? So that's what we want. We want to see results. Why are we doing this stuff, you know?
Yeah, totally. It's exciting. I mean, I'm just, you know, as someone coming in fairly naive in this space, I'm really motivated with what's out there, what's currently out there, and also what's coming. I mean, it's just, it's exciting, right? To see, there's no reason why at this point we can't take our health in our own hands with, you know, with obviously the guidance of a team to, you know, decipher a lot of this stuff. But like, there's no excuses at this point, right? We're aware.
Yeah. And the great thing for you, Mark, is that it all starts with mental fitness. So if you don't have the discipline that you need to execute on the basics of just getting up, eating healthy, working out, getting some sun, you know, doing the basic things takes discipline and it takes a plan and it takes just leaning in and doing it. So that's why we highlight your mental fitness program, everything that you're doing with mental fitness, because I believe that it all starts there.
Yeah. And it's going to, you know, the anecdotal evidence for our listeners out there, this is going to answer a huge question that we have amongst the group as to what age is Mark really, because he's got this awesome silver hair.
The silver
and
fox.
We call him the silver fox. He won't tell us if it's dyed or not. We have no idea. So the next time he gets in the same room with us, we're definitely going to take some blood and figure out what age he is.
I wouldn't expect anything. Yeah, I wouldn't expect any less of you.
He's very maturely, so I'm thinking he's definitely not 35.
I'm the young old man. On that note, great conversation.
Yeah, no, joking aside, I mean, honestly, Ryan's great to talk to. He's got a lot more to tell us, and I know that Philip was chomping at the bit. Philip has got some more questions for him. There's so much more, so looking forward to having him back on.
Yeah, I started geeking out, and I would like to go down a road of some other peptides because we know they're cool. Unfortunately, they're not widely available or may not be as widely available in the future, but cool nonetheless. But again, we stress starting with the basics, because if you don't start with the basics, then all the other things are just going to be like band-aids, and that's just going to be like traditional medicine where you're just putting a band-aid upon a band-aid upon a band-aid and not getting to the root cause, which is what we look at in integrative or functional medicine. So
totally. We'll see you on the other side. All right, you made it to the end of the show. Thank you so much for sticking around, and stay tuned for the next and last episode of this docuseries where I, Rhett, and Philip all jam together summarizing the key insights from the series. And most importantly, with the objective of leaving all of you with actionable steps to achieving your peak health. Of course, if you're enjoying the show, please drop us a review wherever you're listening. They go a long way. And thanks as always for listening.